I'm Jamie Hurst, and for the MSU Denver Alumni Association, we're excited to bring you Bird Talk, a podcast about our alumni, their careers, and their lives.
We are good friends already. What's the line in Step Brothers?
Did we just become best friends?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to go off for like an hour, so just rein me back in.
Today's guest is Flannery Davis Love. Flannery is a 2023 graduate with a master's degree in social work. She is a behavioral specialist at Optum, serving Boulder County Health, where she has sustained interest in working with the athletes in the mental health space. Flannery is an accomplished athlete herself, excelling at Division I soccer before shifting her focus and passion to long-distance running. With her sights set on competing in the Olympic trials for the marathon, she went all in on training in 2022 and qualified in October of 2023. In February 2024, she competed at the Olympic trials in a field of 116 other women, finishing in 74th place. She emphasized the importance of belief, dedication, and owning one's process, underscoring that success in running, as in life, is attainable regardless of background or status. Flannery is a literal roadrunner, and we couldn't be happier to have you with us today. So welcome to Bird Talk, Flannery.
Thanks so much for having me. I love that. Roadrunner.
I know. And so our last episode that we did was a gentleman that walked across the country. And so I got to call him a road walker. And then today when I was going through all my prep materials, I was like, oh, I got to get in a roadrunning joke because that's real this time.
Yeah. Love that. Big pun fan.
Thank you. Before I started doing this podcast and was like, oh, I could never do a podcast, but I wanted to have a podcast called Pun Intended, where I just sat around a table with a bunch of my friends and probably some libations, right? And then we would just tell news stories of things we read. And then I would have to circle to all my friends and they'd have to make a pun and the best pun would win. I don't know if people would watch it or listen to it, but I'd be all for it, right?
Sign me up. I'd subscribe. Do it.
Perfect. Perfect. I love it. So we're so excited to have you today. You are our first graduate student alumni that we are getting to interview. So we're excited to share with our listeners a little bit of a different MSU Denver story, right? We talk oftentimes here about how, especially our undergraduate students, have a very zigzaggy path when they come to MSU Denver. A lot of stops, a lot of starts. Yours on paper is a much more traditional looking path, right? Grew up in the Western Slope, graduated high school in 2012, immediately went to college. We'll talk about your college soccer career for a bit, then came back home, worked for a little bit, and then started grad school. So it seems very in that traditional sense of following the line, but man, do you have some 90 degree turns in there? And so that's what we're excited to talk about, is some big changes today as we look at your undergraduate degree in business and then moving into the healthcare field. And then this love of soccer all of a sudden turning into running for fun. I can't empathize with that. So you are going to have to understand how that happened, but I'm so excited to talk about your journey. But does that feel right, that it was very traditional for a bit and then a few things just happened to just change your path?
Yeah, Jamie, I think you really nailed it on the head. I could not say it better, because it looks traditional and then all of a sudden you're like, wow, that's a pretty nonlinear trajectory. So yeah, I completely agree.
So it's zigzaggy nonetheless, just a little bit, maybe just like one zig and one zag instead of all the usuals that we're there for. But so let's start kind of from the top. So you're from the Western Slope area, went to Palisades High School. So Colorado native, you're now back, but you spent a little bit of time out west in my stomping ground in California. Mm. And so what brought you back to Denver? What brought you back to Boulder?
Yeah, great question. And you know, it's a little bit of a long-winded one, so I'll keep it short for now. Yeah, I ended up going out to California specifically for school and soccer. And to be completely transparent, I picked the school for the program that I was getting recruited for soccer. Thankfully, even when things were going up and down with the sport, I ended up really loving the school. It's a small D1 liberal arts school in Moraga, California, which is like right up the roads from Berkeley.
Yep.
And it was a great experience. But then after college, you know, as things go, everyone kind of takes their own path. And a lot of my friends either moved back in with their folks or people moved back home. And I stayed out there. I had gotten a job working for a health tech startup in sales. And I was really lonely.
I bet.
And I had a bit of a midlife crisis or quarter life crisis around like, what am I doing here?
I like to call it midlife crisis because then it's like, it sounds better than just like quarter life crisis. I feel like people are like, oh, you're 25, you're supposed to. But I'm like, no, it's a mid, so I'm allowed to have it.
Yeah. It counts. Okay.
It does.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I remember kind of thinking, what just happened? Like, I spent so much time investing in myself as an athlete and with a specific group of people who also really valued that. And then all of a sudden, everyone's like, we don't care. you don't care that you did that? No one said that to me directly, but that was the feeling.
It is. It's a tough beast to go from a place where, especially like, so I played sports in college as well. I was a softball player down at UC San Diego.
Oh, cool.
So that's why I was so excited when Brandy and Ruby were like, we have this gal. She played soccer and now she's a runner. I was like, well, running, schmunning, but let's talk about college sports. But it is this hard thing where you're, especially in that setting, you are surrounded by everyone else that has the same goals and commitment that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Your friends or your teammates or other athletes that are on campus. You all live by your own crazy schedule where you're up for weights, up for workouts, whatever the case might be, gone on the weekends. And then you leave and you're trying to find a place in a world that doesn't either have the competitive edge that you had, doesn't have the drive to goals that you have. I got super frustrated just entering the real world and being like, no, accountability is a thing. And it was very hard for me when I became a boss that I was like, so you missed that deadline. Can I make you run? Right? Like, because it's like, how else do you get people to kind of feel that fuel? And it took me a long time to realize that the athlete brain is very different in that regard. And I'm glad I haven't turned that off, but I have learned that I've needed to curtail it in space because it can be very lonely. So I'm sorry that you experienced that, but I don't think you were alone in feeling alone. That's mm-hmm. most of our experiences leaving sports. And I think especially as women too, when mm-hmm. we know that that's the end of it for us, right?
Right. No, 100%. And, you know, it's almost, you know, college is a world of fake adulthood. And then in whatever your community is, mine was sports, it's even more siloed, right? And then all of a sudden you're put out into the world where none of this contrived little bubbles exist and you're just trying to figure out what's going on. So all to say that I was trying to figure out who I was outside of the sport, which I'll come back to because that's a lot of the research and interest I have in the field of psychology and in my career as a social worker and a psychotherapist. But anyways, I digress. Moved back to Denver with a job. That was my first non-linear turn in ecotourism. I had heard of someone who was doing that. I was like, I love to travel. Therefore, I should work in travel. And I ended up applying for this job with an ecotourism company in Louisville, Colorado. Got the gig. And I was like, great. I get to move back home, be closer to my family. I'm pretty close with my folks who still live on the Western Slope. And so, yeah, I just made the move in 2017. I was like, it's time. I love California, but there's a lot of people and not a lot of my people. So it was nice to kind of get back and be closer to family.
Yeah. So it was an ecotourism like adventure company, right? I did a little deep dive this week as I was doing my research. And I was like, what an interesting space that you get to, like, it's safaris and it's places that where, from what I gathered, like tourism with an eye on the fact that we need to preserve these beautiful places that we have. So there must have been a lot of really cool things. Did you get to go on any of the trips or just have to plan them and then look at pictures?
Yeah. So that is one of the biggest perks of working with a company like this is you go on things called site inspection, where if someone cancels or there's room on the trip, you get to go and you're inspecting and investigating the trip in real time. So I was very fortunate. I got to visit polar bears in Canada. I went on a massive safari in East Africa. I went to the Galapagos Islands right before COVID. And that was truly one of the best parts of the job. You were going with the people who you were booking on the trip. That's one thing to keep in mind, which is always a little bit sticky.
So you better not have lied to them at any point in time. Yeah.
Yeah, and you are representing the company. So you're showing up and you're your best self. You are customer service all the time. But I mean, let's be real. It was an incredible experience to get to do those things. I mean, this is incredibly expensive travel, group travel, planned everything for you. It's very luxe. So yeah, I felt very fortunate. And definitely it was an attractive and appealing part of why I took the job.
Well, sure. And especially right out of college and still young and unattached, it's the perfect time to have those kind of jobs.
Yeah.
I say that all the time to students around here. I was like, that's your time to go chase things. Go somewhere else, get uncomfortable in that space because it becomes a lot harder once you have some roots set down and you have a salary and insurance and some of those things that then like when the reasonable, you know, devil on your shoulders, like, don't do that because you're giving up a lot of stability. So it sounds like it was a perfect fit for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. It was great until it wasn't, but I don't have to go down that. And if you don't need me to, yeah.
Fair enough. So after that though, you took a look at MSU Denver. So you started here in our master's program in 2021. First of all, I want to know, like, what made you kind of think about at this point, like, let's start looking at behavioral health, mental health, something in that space. And then why MSU Denver? Because in being in Colorado, there's a lot of opportunity. And so what stuck out to you about this institution that made it feel like it was the right fit?
Yeah, great questions. I will kind of go back into the ecotourism era because it was part of it, but I'll back up even more actually to my time as an athlete. My interest and curiosity around mental and behavioral health really did grow when I was a college athlete. We weren't given a lot of supports when I was in that space, and it was direly needed. It was a pretty volatile environment, especially for my first 3 years. I also suffered a tremendous ankle injury. And more than anything, what I got was, hey, how are your grades? I was a good student. I had like a 3.8, 3.9. So the counselor would say, okay, great, you're doing well. Like, grades look good. You're doing okay. You can't be depressed. You're fine.
Obviously.
Yeah, right? Everything looks great on paper. Therefore, everything's great up here. And so I remember vividly, especially with that mid life crisis, as you call it, kind of thinking, why was there no support or safety nets around this before it happened? And so my brain kind of started going down that pretty early on. I even remember in high school loving psychology, considering it, and someone saying to me, why would you do a psychology degree? What are you going to do with that? And I wish I'd listened to myself. I took the business degree because people pretty much said, oh, there's so much you can do with a business degree. So much you can do. You're an athlete. You'll love sales. You're competitive. Like, okay. But you know, youth is wasted on the young. We have to learn things the hard way sometimes. And so, yeah. Fast forward then to my time once I moved back to Boulder, back to Colorado, I mean, and I started working with this ecotourism company. And I remember within the first year saying to myself, why am I here? And I think transparently felt that most of it was for the perks, right? I get to go on cool trips. The team was an interesting group of people. Still a small company, so ups and downs. But I just remember thinking to myself, I don't see myself here from the very beginning. Then COVID hits. The travel industry is not doing very well, right?
That's not where you want to be employed during that time.
Not where you want to be. And about 30 employees got laid off immediately. I was not part of that, but I very much knew it was coming. And I ended up getting laid off about 2 months later from my job. And it's strange because I was sad, obviously, but after that, it was a feeling of relief. And then a little bit of shame because I was like, are you kidding, Flan? It took this kick in the butt for you to make the move you knew you wanted to make for 2.5 years. But it did.
But I love that. And that's the thing, even as I was listening to you tell that story, you have those thoughts in your brain that are like, this is not really me. I don't fit in. This isn't the feeling that you're supposed to have in that space. And so often those are the hard questions that people don't ask themselves. And many of us don't have the inner monologue that are going to bring it up to us. Mm-hmm. And so I would say for a large portion of our population, they need that external thing like getting laid off to be like, okay, now I can be introspective. I think you're uniquely situated that you had enough of kind of a meshing of your, you know, emotional understanding and emotional intelligence, as well as kind of your gut mm-hmm. feelings to say, no, I knew this before. So that kind of that depression, probably not full, but that sadness or that shame mm-hmm. that you can feel when something devastating, like losing a job happens, could probably have been much more short-lived for you than it is for people that haven't had that inner dialogue before.
Yeah, 100%. And I do think I wish I'd done it earlier. You can always go back, hindsight 2020, but we got there. And as soon as I made the pivot and saying, okay, I know that mental health is where I want to go. I just need to explore what that looks like. I had so much hope and excitement because I looked ahead and I looked 10 years down the line and I was like, I see myself doing that. I see myself being a therapist. I don't know exactly how it's going to look, but that's something I can do for the rest of my life. You're still gambling. Back then, 2020, I was like, well, I hope it's true. This is what we said about soccer. This is what we said about business. So third time's the charm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I took a big gamble on myself and then I did a ton of research and I shadowed people and I talked to people in the field. I talked to every different type of degree that you can get to be a psychotherapist. And there's a lot. And eventually found myself shadowing a woman who is in a similar role that I am in now, who it's primary care integrated behavioral health. And I was like, that's a cool job. And I want that. And I said, what did you do for school? And she's like, I got an MSW.
Okay.
I was like, okay, here we go. So then to answer your question around how I got to MSU, you know, there's not a ton of master's in social work programs in the state. What it really came down to, what I was looking at and where I got accepted was DU. University of Denver, and then Metro, because I didn't want to move. Mm-hmm. I really like where I live. By this point, I was in a pretty serious relationship, really happy in Boulder. I was like, I don't want to leave. And so kind of getting into this more like macro conversation around schooling and higher education is how accessible Metro was in saying, this is a degree I want. The variety of careers available could be interesting when I leave. I feel very fortunate that I found a job that values psychotherapists, values social workers. That's not always the case. And I knew that going into it. And so saying, okay, do I want to be $100,000 in debt? No.
Yeah, 100%.
And Metro, I really love Metro's mission. And as you mentioned, a lot of kids who come here for undergrad and saying, how can we make school affordable and accessible for anyone who wants it? Can always be better. But Metro is, I think, an example of that in our state where people can say, I can do this and I can achieve dreams. And this is how I can get there.
I feel like that was just the billboard for our next admissions motto, you know? and it's almost like we primed you, but we didn't. That's the most exciting part, is because I think the truth of the institution comes through, right? That's one of the things that's kept me here for 10 years at MSU Denver. Mm-hmm. We say who we are and then we actually do it. There's a lot of other places, and especially in higher ed, kind of to your point, there's a lot of value propositions that are stated, and even things like get a business degree because that's where you're going to fit in. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm saying anything bad about business degrees. They are perfectly versatile and wonderful things. But there's a lot of these value propositions we add to things that are not necessarily true for everybody. And so it's wonderful that as an institution, we can say, no, education is for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's accessible. It's affordable. And we're going to meet you halfway there. And then we actually do that. So I'm glad to hear that we're doing that, not just for our undergraduate students, but in our graduate space too, which is incredible.
Yeah, 100%. And to see the different types of people in my class and the undergraduate, because we were all kind of together, and it's every type of person who is going for the degree they want. It's people who work full time. It's people who are parents. It's people who do that more traditionally like me. But I also look back on my own path and the traditional route I took, and I wonder if I had taken some time to really think about what I wanted instead of saying, this is the cookie cutter way.
Yeah.
I need to go to college and then get a job and do all these things. And at the time it was right. But I look at people who do it less traditionally and more bravely, in my opinion. And I say, wow, you are really doing critical work and figuring out what you want to do and probably saving a ton of money. And so MSU really, I think, provides the opportunity to do that. Yeah,
it does. I think
from someone who went to a private four-year university in the hills of Northern California.
Yeah, that one hurts a little bit, right? But now you...
Yeah, I would not have been there without scholarship.
Fair. But I do think about that often, because even I went to law school a little bit later in life too. So I was the old kid in law school classes. And I remember, you know, I'd sit there and I'd watch these kids open up their laptop and they'd be shopping or they'd be watching TV in this middle of this lecture. And I'm sitting here, and not that I'm the most responsible human on the planet. I play by most rules because I have a fear of constantly getting in trouble. I think it's the athlete in me that it's, you know, the when your coach used to say, like, you know, and if you think I'm talking about you, then I am. I would always be sitting in the circle like, well, she's talking about me. She's not. But, you know, it just was such a fresh, I'm just that kid, right? But I remember seeing these, you know, young men and women like doing anything but paying attention to the lecture. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there like literally counting in my head and doing the math of like, at a private law school, every minute that I'm in this classroom, this is what I'm paying. And I was paying tuition, right? Mm. I wasn't on scholarship. I was well beyond my parents' support at that point in time. Right. I was in my 30s. And I just remember sitting there quantifying how hard I was going to learn and study and make sure that I absorbed what was being presented to me, mm-hmm. because there was a value assigned to it based on my work. And I think that is one of the benefits that we see with a lot of our students here, especially the ones that are not coming right out of high school. Not that there aren't ones that do come from high school that are like this. Mm. But when it's your dollar, when it's your time, and you are very consciously aware of what else you could be doing in this time that maybe could be earning more income or spending more quality time with family or whatever the case is, you're that much more intent on making the time that you spend in a classroom and studying count. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that a lot the older we get. And I wish I would have known that at 19, 20 when I did anything but went to class, right?
Yeah. And I mean, what you talk about with your law school is exactly what it was for me. You know, this was on me to invest in. And it changes when it's your dollar and you don't have scholarship or parents being fortunate enough, privileged enough to have parents who can support you through undergrad and saying, this is something I want and I'm going to be paying for it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And we just know that psychologically. Yeah, it changes things. It definitely does. Yeah.
It does. So you said something when you were talking about that I kind of want to circle back to when you were talking about your path, that the time that you spent in undergrad, now kind of retrospectively, you're sitting there thinking, gosh, we should have had more support services kind of intertwined with what is there. For those of us that are listening that are not Division I athletes or haven't been in that space, I worked in Division I athletics for a long time. So when you were talking about your counselor, that was my job. I was an academic advisor for women's soccer, gymnastics, golf programs at Iowa State. So, I'm like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've got a roster of 150 kids that I need to make sure are academically eligible and for the most part, just functioning as adultish as they can, right? Mm-hmm. But some of the issues you'd see, I mean, I remember having a men's golfer come in my office and was panicking because he ran out of clean underwear and socks and didn't know what to do. So he was going to go to Target to buy more. And I had to be the person, first person in his life to say, like, here's how we turn on a washing machine and here's how you do a load of laundry, right? So you're dealing with a gamut of whatever might happen. But I will say, especially in the early to mid 2000s, like, mental health was not in that space.
Right.
And especially at not Power Five Division I schools. Yeah, you might be getting that at UCLA, at SC, you know, things in the Pac-12 over on the west side, but not in the conferences that, you know, Santa Clara, St. Mary's, Pepperdine. It's not existing there. And so I heard you say that it would have been something that was great. And I just have to wonder naturally, is that why, especially in the position that you're in now, where you're part of this integrated healthcare model, is that what made it so exciting to you to kind of bring in the mental health to this whole idea of what holistic care looks like?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I love that this is something you're already in. You and I could probably have a whole entire other conversation around the systemic implications of the NCAA, which is a massive passion project of mine based on my lived experience and now my time in the field. But to your point, we had an academic advisor, and I want to be very clear that it should not have been on that person. I don't want to villainize her.
No.
Because she was put in a situation where she's like, okay, this is my job, and I'm required to make sure they can get on that soccer field, which means they need to have a 2.5 GPA.
And pass a certain amount of credits. Yeah.
And so that was her job.
It's hard because, especially in those spaces, right? So you have a head coach, you probably have at least one full-time assistant, maybe two, or a GA in that space. Then you have your academic advisor that is in the athletics department. You have your university academic advisors, but I don't know about you. I never met mine because my sports one took care of everything for it.
Right.
And then we're not really talking about the other issues unless something comes up as a red flag enough to keep you off the field of play, right? So to your point, if you're a 3.8 student, my time, especially as an academic advisor, I'm looking at my 4.0s to 3.0s. I am giving you whatever help you need to register for classes and make sure that you hit your study hall hours. I am not spending time investing in what might be at the heart of some things that could be a struggle for. Now, that's not to say that, especially with a bunch of female teams, the amount of breakups and those conversations, because, you know, you become very close to your academic advisor because they're the younger person that isn't your coach. Like, I had nothing I could threaten. I can't make you run. I can't make you do burpees.
Right.
But I can come to you and get mad at you for missing class. But it was not a well-staffed position. I think it has changed. And I would love to know, since it is a passion project for you, if you think it's moving in the right direction or not, because I'm seeing it in small doses. Even here at MSU Denver, as a Division II institution, we have a majority of our programs that have sports psychologists that they are leveraging to make sure that their teams have somebody to talk to, that their coaches are being trained in a way that is much more competent of what needs to happen in a space when you're dealing with competition and pressures and really just the change in students. I mean, I left college in 2005. Mm-hmm. We still could get cussed at and forced to run and all of those things that now we would look at and say, that's probably not great. 2012, probably similar. 2024, it's a different beast.
It is.
Right? So we're seeing some improvements in places, but it still is a big pot of who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're 100% right, which is that this has changed tremendously in the last 5 to 10 years, because even when I was graduating in 2016, as you said, there were no mental health specialists, providers, psychologists in the space. Whether there was no funding or there was no thought around it, I don't know. But that has changed substantially. And I think part one is COVID. Mental health has become a pretty appealing, sexy term, right? Everyone's talking about it. Therapy is for everyone. It's not just because you're not doing well, right? Or you're going crazy, right? This is really interesting language that we've started to see shift. And I do think the other part of it, at least from my perspective, when you think about the systemic, system-wide changes, is there was a lot of suicide happening in college sports, and there still is.
Yeah.
And there's a few big cases. There's a goalkeeper at Stanford, Katie Meyer, who died a couple of years ago. Tremendously heartbreaking. And there's actually a woman who works for ESPN. I can't remember her name right now, but she wrote a book that is absolutely fascinating and to this day, one of my favorites, which is What Made Maddie Run. And it's about a girl who played soccer and ran in high school, ended up deciding to run in college. And she, from the outside, had everything together, right? She had good grades. She looked happy. Her social media presence was all the things you'd want it to be to say, okay, she's doing really well. And then she takes her own life. Mm. And Kate Fagan, that's her name. And that book sat with me for a long time. And I'm very fortunate to never have thoughts like that. But I have teammates and friends and people I know who struggled tremendously in college, not all because of the system, but in part because of a volatile situation and coaches who were trained and incentivized to win games, not develop people. And there is something tremendously concerning about that. Mm-hmm. And where we're headed in the NCAA worries me a bit, right? I think, not to go off the deep end, but NIL contracts, what we are expecting from young athletes and what we are prioritizing in college sports for people who are going to school, right? We are student athletes, not athlete students, mm-hmm. is continuing to shift. But the happy part of this is that there is a shift in the mental health presence. CU Boulder right now, they have a full department who I would love to work for someday that supports the athletes and also consults with coaches on how we can best support people and what they hear from athletes. Hey, coach, you know, we've been seeing lately a lot of people are having performance anxiety or struggling with X, Y, and Z. How's practice been going? What is the interactions you're having with your athletes? That's what I hope is happening behind closed doors, but that's occurring all over the country, right? So
yeah.
So I got my pedestal, but that's kind of my initial thoughts on all that. Yeah.
I am with you. And even just in the last, 2 months of all the legal things that are happening from an NCAA perspective, I don't know if you saw this week, Dartmouth's men's basketball team unionized. Mm. So they have now formed a union, which means they have negotiation powers for salary and for working hours, which includes practice. And so we'll see where that goes. Then there's a handful of antitrust litigations that are happening in California, and even Colorado is a part of some of that. So I teach a class in sport law here at MSU Denver, and it's my favorite time when we get to this stuff because I get to basically say, oh, what you know of the NCAA will be gone in 5 years.
Yeah.
And I am a huge advocate in amateur athletics, and especially in the opportunities that, especially I think as a woman, knowing that mm-hmm. there wasn't an opportunity for me to play professional softball, not that I was good enough to do so. That was my, I think you put it in terms of that's my parade. That's mm-hmm. what you talked about your Olympic trials as, right? Like, this is it for me. This is what I could do. I think you approach it a little bit differently than maybe some men do, and especially men in dominant sports that have professional leagues. So I really think it needs to stay at an NCAA level. I think mm-hmm. there's so much value to the idea of a student athlete, but all of that is getting blown up with all the litigation that's around the corner. And then I think the NIL, just to your point, just adds the pressure that is actually, it's bad for everybody.
Right.
I mean, people are getting money and people are getting their payday. That's great. But when you talk to some of these coaches about their recruiting, like even just after the football season ended, there were so many interviews with coaches that are saying if they're going into the portal to pick up a quarterback now, power mm-hmm. five quarterback, it's going to be a $2 million transaction. And that's not the university shelling $2 million out. That's them having to find the right NIL agreements to get somebody to come to their school that maybe they're going to like, maybe they're not going to like. They're not even considering the fit, the coach, mm-hmm. The university, what they're studying. They're literally looking at the dollar amount that they can get from an NIL contract. And to me, that is terrifying, because what is that, A, teaching you as a young person whose brain is not fully involved? Because also, I hate to break it to you, the rest of us, we're not picking jobs because we're getting a $2 million signing bonus, right? We're picking jobs because it's a fit with a mission. It's a fit with the work we want to do. Our gut and our stomach is saying, this is where I feel I can be impactful. I think the wealth of opportunity that you have to study this and be on the forefront of studying this can get you published in just about anything, because we are going to see a serious meltdown in, I think, the behavioral and mental health of the young men and women that are in college right now and probably on the cusp of college, because it's going to be a whole different sense of lonely than what you and I felt when we were just no longer part of a team.
Yeah.
This is going to be, I'm no longer part of a team and people aren't just paying me to put pictures on Instagram to say that I like their company.
Right.
That's crazy.
So it's the Wild West.
It is.
It really is. And, you know, for especially basketball and football, I get it. These kids feel taken advantage of. But then maybe we should make college basketball and football professional sports.
100%.
And fundamentally, college sports, I believe in the mission that we're there to go to school, that I even didn't believe at the time. And that I still got a good education. And at the end of the day, I knew that's why I was there. And that this idea with NIL contracts is starting to just muddy the waters. And to your point, it's going to look completely different.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. And I hope that there is, yeah, some consideration for mental health above it all, because it's going to get intense.
It's going to get really messy.
Yeah.
MSU Denver's annual Day of Giving is right around the corner. Mark your calendars and get ready to join the Roadrunner community on April 11th, 2024 for MSU Denver's 8th annual Day of Giving. 24 hours dedicated to raise the resources and support our students need to rise. For more information, visit msudenver.edu/giving. This episode is brought to you by The Seagull. If it flew over a bay, it would be a bagel.
Enough about that. Let's talk about the really cool things that you've done in the sports space. I got myself all fired up and I'm like, thank God it's a Friday afternoon. So after this, I can just cool down a bit. So anyhow, let's talk about running, something I know nothing about. So that'll give you the floor to be able to talk about it, since I haven't ran since someone told me that I had to. You have this soccer background, which I know based on all the things you've said so far and the articles and stuff I've read has really informed the extent to which you chose to really dive into a long distance running career. But no history in long distance running. I mean, as a soccer player, you run what, like 3 miles a game, but yeah, you know, in spurts. So enough to catch a break. But then all of a sudden you're like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run marathons. How does that happen? What switched in your brain to be like, I'm going to be one of those people? And I say that jokingly because there's Andy Schlichting in our room right now. He was a college football player. And all of a sudden now he runs marathons. And I'm always like, but why? Like, I just don't get it. So this is for all of us, Andy.
Oh yeah. 10, 15 years ago, you would have asked me this question and I would have had the same answer. I did not like running. I only ran after a ball.
Yeah.
That was my mission. And then even in high school, the track coach would come poach some soccer athletes. And at the time, I didn't realize this, but part of the reason I was such a good soccer player is because I had endurance. Both of my parents are runners. That's something to know. There's a genetic component. My mom was a middle distance runner. My dad, to this guy Andy's point, was a football player who at Cornell switched to track and field after the first year playing football. And so anyways, I had it in there. I was a very, rebellious teenager in that I wanted to forge my own path. And I also just didn't like running. Didn't really enjoy it. So yeah, the track coach would come over, try to poach us. And he'd be like, yeah, do you want to run the 1600? No. Okay, what do you want to run?
No one wants to run that.
I was like, I will run the 100 meter hurdles and the relay.
100%. What is the least amount I have to run? 100. I just met a young woman the other night at our scholarship dinner who told me that she runs the 800. And I was like, that sounds horrible. You are sprinting for a half of a mile. That is the worst case scenario. I'm not doing that unless I'm chased by a bear, right? Like, to have to be at full speed for a half a mile, no thank you. And I used to joke in college that if I could just hit the ball far enough, I could jog. So it's more cost effective and time sensitive to be able to work on my hitting so that I could hit long balls and just jog instead of having to run 60 feet at a time. Because for a softball player, that's a lot, you know? So I'm with you.
Yeah, I just wasn't my shtick. You know, I wasn't really enjoying it. And then in college, you know, once again, looking back, I could see that even the reason I got recruited as the position I was recruited for, which is an outside back, I won't get into the weeds around that position, but in a certain formation that was pretty common at the time I was playing,
it was a lot of running.
And I was really good at that. And I liked playing defense and I liked getting forward and playing offense. And I had a really great left foot. I had a killer left foot. So that is part of the reason I got recruited. And at the time, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, it's just soccer. I'm just playing soccer. So anyways, fast forward, and I am feeling a bit crispy post-college career, injury, all the things, and I'm like, yeah, I need a break. you know, I wasn't like not ready to never touch a ball again, but I was like, I want something else. And it kind of came back in my head that, oh, my parents ran, you know, maybe I should try running. And I'm also a little bit wiser, right? A little less rebellious. So I start running my senior spring, because soccer's over, like 2 to 4 miles around campus. And I am just absolutely thrashed by it. Yeah. I was like, this is so hard. I cannot do more than 4 miles. And then, you know, you fast forward another year and I'm signing up for a trail half marathon. Like, oh God, it's so hard. I'm never going to go more than this. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then the big change really was I moved to Boulder. I'm not sure how well you all know Boulder, but it's a bit of a bubble, first of all, and a mecca around athletics, particularly cycling and running. And I meet a group of people, partly through my now husband, called the Rocky Mountain Runners, who, above all else, have done a tremendous job at creating community. And when I think about sport, especially as a team athlete, that's, I think, underneath it all, what I was searching for. Is community, connection.
So we talk about that at length on this podcast, that that's the heart of everything. And so sometimes MSU Denver is the community that people need at that time. Other times it's the environments that you're in. But community is at the heart of all the things that if we could just focus on that and have enough wisdom to say that, oh, that's actually what that gap is that I'm feeling, that hole in my heart or that, you know, whatever I'm missing is that community. And then also realize that it's not necessarily a specific type of community. It's the people that make that, right? Because it's easy. You can now retrospectively, I'm sure, look back and say, oh yeah, I needed a community when I lived in the Bay Area. And then it's like, oh, well, I need sports again. That was my community. And it's like, no, sports was the mechanism for you to find the people to have shared values, shared interest, and shared care for. So that's awesome that you found that at a young age, you know, that you realized or had that click of to be like, no, I need a community. And even if it's going to be crazy long distance runners, so be it, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I was missing in that limbo period between my undergrad and moving here. And I, once I started joining run clubs, even in the Bay Area, I was like, oh, these are fun people. These people are so cool. So when I moved here, that's the first thing I did was search run clubs. And I'm so happy I did because it just brought me this tremendous group of people and they are fully off the deep end. That's the first thing I'll say. These people run forever. And then when I first joined this run club, I was like, this is not for me. And then all of a sudden, 2 years later, I'm running the Leadville 100,
right?
You know, and I'll kind of not go through all of how it got there. Cause I was not drinking the tea at first. Mm-hmm. I was like very, very nervous about it all. But then, you know, being in nature, being with friends, community, all those good things kind of come up and all of a sudden you're doing things you never thought you could do.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the first part of this where I spent so much time trail running out of college or once I was in the state of running and with that community. And then, you know, it slowly became apparent that I had potentially some talent and potential to work with from a speed point of view.
Sure.
And we're trail running, there's walking, hiking, running, long distance stuff with eating, you know, you drink Coca-Cola and you eat candy and then you kind of come over to the dark side is what they call it, which is road running.
Okay.
It's a different ball game, but there's something that I found so addicting about it. And it did pull back on those strings of competition from when I was younger and how I found identity and value in myself. And I had to be really intentional this time around because I felt I have a lot of curiosity for why I felt so devastated after a career in something I love, like soccer, to say, how can I do it differently this time? How can I do it better and be more balanced?
Yeah.
And saying, I love running. I am a runner, but I'm also all of these other things. And the reason I run is because of the community.
Yeah.
And it is not, you know, sports that have created my character. My character has helped define and pursue sport. And that sounds so simple, but it's such a difficult tightrope to walk. And once I started doing that, especially as I started running faster marathon distances, shorter, I kept saying, because I went from 100 to running marathons.
Sure. Those short marathons. Yeah. Did they name a marathon after the guy who had to run right to that in Greece? And didn't he die at the end of it?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So shorter than a death
shorter
run.
Than the
okay.
Death run. That's what they're calling it. But yeah, I just got really excited about it. And I started realizing that I had some speed to work with and I might as well start to look at that while I've got it. Because people run hundreds, you believe it,
sure.
Until they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s. But if I'm going to run a fast marathon, there's a time period to do it.
Sure.
And I just really enjoyed it. And I found incredible mentors. Someone who coached me, who I really loved working with, was Noel Rojas, who is a tremendous boulder-based athlete. She's one of the top marathoners in the country. And she was a tremendous impact on my road running build and helped me get to the point where I was running a 236 marathon, you know, just in October. So yeah, it's been a wild ride.
literally wild run.
Yeah.
As I was looking at kind of your running progression, so you had to shave, what, 12 minutes off your marathon to qualify?
Mm-hmm.
That can't be easy. I mean, that's a fifth of your time that you're out there. How do you even go about something? Is it a mental challenge of like, try to break it down and say, okay, I need to shave 20 seconds off every minute? Or was it like, I just need to really push in these set of miles? And again, you can tell I know nothing about strategizing for running. For me, it was like sprint to first base, right? Get out of the way of the moving car as you cross the street. But how do you approach that? Is it more of a global thing? Is that something that, did you find successes in doing it one way versus another? I'm just curious.
Yeah, you're asking all the right questions. I'm impressed. I think subconsciously for me in this journey, there was a lack of commitment that I was willing to give to be competitive in sport again.
Well, sure, because there's vulnerability that comes with it. You were hurt the last time. Sorry, I'm doing this interview for you, but but it's so resonating, right? Like the last time I went that all in on something, I got broken and I was hurt and people around me hurt me. I hurt myself. I didn't treat myself there. So why would I want to jump into it again?
Yeah, I failed at that thing. And then I defined myself at that failure. I had a objectively unfulfilling college career. And I have no trouble saying that now because look where it's brought me,
yeah.
Right? But at the time, it was devastating. And to fail again, I was so scared to mean that, right? This is like in therapy, we talk about when black and white thinking happens. And if I fail at this thing, it means I am a failure in life.
Mm.
And that was fully on board for me, right? And so once again, this time around, I got to kind of reset that mold. And when I started really getting serious about marathons, I had to answer that for myself around, okay, why have you not been willing to commit, right? I would give Nell 6 to 8 weeks the past times I'd done a marathon. And she's like, are you kidding? I'd be like coming off 100, or I was coming back from my honeymoon. And she's like, okay, are you ready to train? You know, Chicago marathons in 6 weeks. I'm like, no, one more week. I need to go do a trail run. It's so beautiful outside. I don't want to be.
Sounds like I got 5 weeks before I got to worry about that. Yeah.
And then that specific example, I got an overuse injury.
Right.
I had to take 10 days off for the marathon, but I still ran it. And that was addicting because I had a really good time and I was still able to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran like a 2:48. So that was the last time I ran a marathon. And I remember saying to Nell, I was like, I want to go for the trail. I want to go for the time.
Yeah.
Even though it had just dropped, mind you, this is a little bit of context. In 2020, the Olympic trials qualifying time was a 2:45. 500 women made it. They're like, we cannot afford to send 500 women to Atlanta. We need to change things.
Yeah.
And it's not a participation award. These are women who should be able to go to the Olympics. So they changed it and they moved it 7 minutes back. Mind you, my PR at the time was a 2:48. And they moved the boundary from a 2:45 to a 2:37. And I said, I want to go for it. And Nell says to me, she's like, okay, you're going to have to give me some more time, Flynn. And in my head, I say, yeah, okay. I'm like, because I realized at that moment, I was like, I haven't been willing because I haven't wanted to fail. I haven't wanted to look that bull in the eye and say, that's so scary. And I want to go for it. And that does mean I could fail.
Right.
But I'm going to commit and I want no excuse. So March of 2023, I gave myself all the time in the world that I could think of, right? I trained for a half marathon from March to June, had a quick trail running break. And then in July, I went right into marathon training. So that is what, March, April, May, June, July, August. That's 7 months of road training. And when you ask, how did I get there? There's no trick. There's no magic. It's commitment. It's dedication. And what's really scary about that is that you have to start to discern and within yourself when there is commitment and dedication to a cause and when you start to sacrifice yourself for it.
Yeah.
And when you say, okay, I care about this thing a lot, it is not going to define who I am. Really difficult work.
I see it all the time. And especially, I think even when I talked about earlier, like a hard transition for me coming into the non-athletic work world was that things that I took for granted, those intangible things that are just embedded into us. Like you're early, like my coach used to always say, you know, if you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. If you're late, you're left. Because it's true. If the bus was leaving at 8:15 and you got there at 8:15, you're that doesn't count, right? So like the little things about being on time, the accountability, especially in a team sport setting, that it's like, you know, especially in a failure sport like softball, I'm going to make an error. I'm going to strike out. What am I going to do the next inning to be in that space? You're going to miss a pass. You're going to let somebody go, you know, whatever the case might be. Mm-hmm. And so it was curious for me coming into the workforce to realize that not everybody has that as ingrained in them as who they are as a person. And it took me a long time to realize that I had to be very thoughtful that when I give feedback, or even when in the conversations that I have with people around me, whether it's my staff or my peers or even my bosses, mm-hmm. when I say that something that was done incorrectly, I have to be very thoughtful to make sure that I'm not saying that you are incorrect or you are wrong or you are a failure. And that to me felt like why am I taking 15 extra steps to say something that people should just know that, hey, you missed that deadline. So you failed on that deadline. Not that I'd say the word fail, but that was translated in so many people's brains as, well, I'm a failure. Mm-hmm. And that is one of those things that I feel like, man, I'm so glad that I had sports to teach me that that wasn't the case. Because again, if I failed 7 out of 10 times, I'm still a 300 hitter and I'm sitting at the top of conference, right? So I'm used to that failure is going to happen. That doesn't define me, but it is a different mindset. And I think especially when you're now reinventing this and kind of creating your own mold and own expectations and with enough emotional intelligence to be able to say, I get to do it my way this time. How fortunate to be able to set those parameters for yourself, because then you're the one that's in control of them, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And to that point in saying it is an opportunity to fail, and that in itself is a gift. And it's so hard to tell yourself that as an 18-year-old kid.
Right.
It takes considering how to teach our kids to value multidimensionality and range. And I think easier said than done, but I look forward to a world where we start to say to kids, whatever their activity of choice is, this isn't just sports, right? This is so translatable. If you're a type A student, mm-hmm. if you are a musician, you know, whatever it is that defines who you are in a high school setting, that brings you community, mm-hmm. that brings you self-worth, that's great. But how can we also help kids say, hey, look at all these other things that are important to who you are? And that's a lot of my interest. Yeah.
And I think the part that makes it even crazier now for kids today, as opposed to us, is the social media reinforcement, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even just talking with my nieces and nephews, I've got nieces and nephews all the way from what, sixth grade to college. The amount of affirmation that is dedicated to whether or not someone likes something, reposts something, whatever platform you're on, blows my mind. Mm-hmm. Because I'm thinking, you're creating your worth, your self-worth, your value proposition based on whether other people think that what you do is cool or not. And to me, I'm just, when I think about the mental health space, and especially with adolescents and with young people, that's got to be a whole new, I don't even know the word. What I want to say is cluster, but I don't think I can say that on Spotify. So a whole new dumpster fire of situations to have to deal with as a professional, right?
I cannot imagine being a kid in today's age. Mm-mm. And I feel for them. I feel for every teenager, every parent, every single one of them, the new, what is it, Generation Alpha, they're calling the next one. And I see videos of what 10-year-olds are, and I'm like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. it was hard enough to do it when I just had Slinkies and an Envy, right? I didn't have a smartphone until college, right. And I'm so happy I didn't even have
I didn't have a phone till college, right? Yeah.
It is a mind-blowing world to be thinking about all this, right? And what our kids are being kind of surrounded by, what they're being tempted towards and what is taking their attention. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do just want to point out, because I think this is incredible. So you went to the Olympic trials, you finished 74th, but you were seeded to finish 167th. That is incredible. So not only, I mean, and again, Olympic trials, they changed it a bit, right? I think it's only what, 2 or 3 women and 2 men now. It's crazy, whoever. And again, they're at different trial settings from what I was reading. It sounds like you can qualify in one space and still not be eligible. So you had to have walked into that race as like, okay, I'm not going to finish. You know what the times are. It's pretty objective. I'm not going to finish in the top 3. But to shave, what is that? What's quick math here? 90 people off of where you needed to finish. I mean, that had to feel like one of the biggest victories that you could have possibly imagined at that moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when I was leading up to this race, it didn't. And the reason why, you know, I just ran the race of my life in October. It felt like a shot in the dark. Even though I had trained so much, I was like, this could go really well. I think I can do this thing, but it could also, I could fail. And I was prepared to that, just like we mentioned. And then I got it. It was like this elation. Yeah. It was amazing. And then it's like time to train for another marathon. And oh, by the way, for me, to your point, not being self-deprecating, it is fully participatory. And you've done your research because there's all these tiers of being, you can qualify for the trials, but not be qualified with the Olympic standard for Paris,
right,
which I didn't have. So when I tell people, yeah, I'm not going to the Olympics, they'd be like, don't say that. Give yourself a chance. And I'd have to say, I need to explain to you the actual logistics of the fact that I'm not going to the Olympics.
Yeah.
And that, as you said earlier, this is my parade. This is my Olympics. And initially, for someone who's a very competitive type A personality with sport, that was so hard to say, there's no exterior goal here for me to hit. There's no time. I'm doing this for me. I'm doing this because I like it. I'm doing this to celebrate this past marathon.
Yeah.
And then to say and get there, okay, it's going to be hot. I won't get into the details of that, but the race started at 10:20 for a variety of reasons in Florida. And I remember thinking of myself as I'm warming up, already sweating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this is not going to be a PR day. That's okay. It's a mental toughness day. And that is where I credit a lot of the mental toughness and community I have in Boulder, because trail running is all about mental toughness. It is all up here. And so I ran out really conservatively in that race. And people were dropping starting mile 8. People were just dropping. And I just started catching people.
Wow.
And
so that's how you finished 70 in front. 70 people panned out because they got so humid and fell over. I get it. I see.
Well, and to your point, okay, so 116 women finished, 140 started.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea of how many people dropped. And I just started passing people, not because I was going that much faster, but because I had gone out so conservatively. Now, don't get me wrong, my race still, to use your words, became a dumpster fire in the last 10K, which, to be honest, is quite normal in a marathon. I got very lucky. The marathon I qualified with, I felt great the entire time. Let me tell you, that rarely happens. I'm realizing that. I will hold that race close forever because I was able to push in the last 3 miles where the trials, I was hanging on for dear life. My calves were cramping and locking for the last 10K. And I was like, hang on, plan. You just gotta get to the finish.
Yeah.
And I at first was like, oh gosh, I ran a 2:41, like not even close to my PR in terms of marathon times. And then I had to say, okay, you came in 74th. And you were one of the, to be completely frank, I was seated almost second or third to last because with my time, which was a 2:36:43, and the trials qualified me off of gun time, not chip time, was the 2:36:52.
Oh, geez. So you had 8 seconds.
8 seconds. Even though, and so I was at the bottom, I call myself the worst of the best. And I had to reframe that again and be like, how many women, how many people I know would kill to be here?
Yeah.
Like, do not do this to yourself. Do not self-sabotage into saying you could be better. You're not doing enough because you just came in 74th in the country and you made it here,
yeah.
Making it here. And I had to really be aware and conscious of that, of the gratitude to get there, because I got incredibly fortunate and a lot of hard work to qualify my first time.
Right.
And I know people who did 7 or 8 marathons last year to try to go to the trials.
Mm.
And so there was a very conflicting emotions, right? You're not good enough. You ran a 2:41 to, you are here. You're doing it. You're 74th. You've got gratitude. I smiled almost the whole time. And I think that's what I'm most proud of, is I had so much fun. My family was out there visiting, or I was out there supporting me. Friends flew out. That is why I was there. And so I had to kind of tilt this up on a pedestal to kind of, you know, even this out and say, it's okay. You know, it's okay that it's not perfect.
This has been so great. And you are a fantastic podcast guest because you did what I'm supposed to do, which is always bring things kind of full circle. So thank you for helping me out there. But it is such a great story. And I know we started by talking about it wasn't really a zigzaggy path on paper, but man, it sure has been for you. And what I think I love most about your journey, and where I think I get most excited for you in your future, is that everything seems to have had kind of that full circle moment. So even as hard as your your Division I athletics experience might have been, it brought you into this new space that now has opened your eyes to what other people need in these spaces. So there's a lot of connecting of dots, and that is so fortunate to have at such a young age. And so I'm so excited for what that means and the platform and the foundation you've built to be able to do that type of work thoughtfully with the clients that you see, with the communities that you're a part of. And I'm just so glad that I've gotten to meet you today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I guess the last thing I would just say, just because you've wrapped it up so nicely, is, you know, people's stories, right? I think that's why we do podcasts. That's why I'm a clinician. I love people's stories. And when I think about how you just summed it up, which is looking at the trajectory of my life, you could stop, you could do a stopgap or a chapter stop anywhere. And you could say, okay, if you stopped my book after college, yeah, I'd be pretty sad, right? I'd be like, that is unfulfilling. And there's actually a specific kind of therapy, not to plug this in, but called narrative therapy, that talks about this, which is saying getting to choose and empowering yourself to decide when it is a chapter and when it keeps going. And that if you extend the chapter, you extend the book. Now, if I'm to pull my book up to where I'm at now, that was all part of the equation. And that has been the appetizer, so to speak, for this main course, where I get to enter a new part of being an athlete and a clinician and all these other parts of my identity, and saying the best is yet to come. And I wouldn't be here with that perception if without all of those experiences. And so for Petro students, it is, you have incredible range. I think of the student population at Metro and being a part of that. And I'm so inspired, because look what it did for me. Look what having range did for me. And that's all these people who are at school there and kind of trying out and being brave in their trajectory. So yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks for all your help with it. Yeah.
I love that too. And just that idea, I think the encouragement too of also just not being powerless against stopping your chapter too soon, right? Because if we did, there's so many chapters in my life. If I would have stopped there, I'd have a whole different life. Maybe I'd be here. Maybe I wouldn't. Who knows what that looks like? And so just that encouragement and that optimism to know, like, nope, there's another page. Keep flipping the page. I love it. I love it. All right. I do have 3 rapid fire questions we ask everybody. So I do need you to answer these. So the first one, what is your favorite MSU Denver memory?
Graduation.
That's awesome.
Do you want me to elaborate? I'm not sure if
You're fine. You can hit it as however you want.
Graduation and getting to see everybody who's graduating, right? Getting to see everyone, all the different types of people, having my family there. Such a great moment.
It is cool. I've been a part of, I've worked in higher ed my whole life in different capacities. I love MSU Denver commencements way more than I even loved my own or any other institution I've been to, simply because you see this as a pinnacle moment. This is maybe a chapter closed for somebody, but knowing that the next page is going to flip. And I love seeing students with their children or with their spouses or with their parents and grandparents, and the amount of caps that are decorated, you know, like I did at first gen, like, you know, that this is a defining moment, not just for them, but for their entire family and their community, because they might be the first to do that.
Yeah.
And that part just gets me every single time, mm-hmm. for sure. Okay, second question. What does it mean to you to be a roadrunner? And this might be different for you, because you got 2 different roadrunning terms.
I want to get literal with it. It is the 2 shoes by my door that I'm going to go put on 2 hours from now. Just kidding. it's funny, because being a roadrunner, you know, I have this now as a master's student, this like double mascot, because I was a Gael, which people might know, it's G-A-E-L, which is like a Celtic warrior. So I'm a Gael wearing running shoes. Like, that's what I think of, right? And that, as funny as it is, I do think of being a road runner. I mean, it's pretty synonymous with my experience coming into road running, and then kind of what has happened in conjunction with that, right? I got to start road running and running away with my career, running away with this new way of thinking and being really informed and intentional in that. So I'm playing into the pun because I have to.
I love it. I love it. I absolutely love it. Okay, last one is, if you could put a billboard anywhere on campus with a piece of advice for students to see, what would it say?
I would say where it would be or what it would be or both.
Well, we usually say what would it say, but yeah, if you have a place you want to put it, you let me know that too.
I was like, I don't know if I can remember, because the only place I was at was Central Classroom, so maybe I'd put it there. I would put something that I had on my sticky note when I was training for my marathon, which is, you can be anything and everything you want to be.
It's awesome. You can.
And that involves some fine print, but at the end of the day, it's true. It really is. Mm-hmm.
It is. It is. Well, this was so great, Flannery. I'm so excited to have met you.
Great. I really appreciate you all. It was really fun. It's my first podcast experience, so it's going to be a high bar to follow.
It is. I do have one thing since we're best friends now. Have you seen the Instagram reel of the lady and the guy that go out running on a snowy day? And she's just like, it's just so delightful. And then she just eats shit completely. Exactly. Like, oh, it's soft and it's fun to run and just bam out. So when you said that you might not go for a run today, all I could think in my head is, I hope she does, and I hope she doesn't slip. Because that meme lives in my head as one of the greatest things ever.
Oh, it's so funny. It's the perfect tackiness, and then she eats it. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. I love it. I love it. All right, we are best friends. All right, perfect.
Yeah, call me.
Don't eat it if you go running, and then we will communicate with you soon.
Appreciate it. Thanks again,
awesome.
Y'all. Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bird Talk, special accommodation provided by University Advancement. Thank you to Ruby Matheny, Brandy Rideout, production provided by David Sharman, and I'm your host, Jamie Hurst. Keep running, roadies.